Hello everyone, this is Space Cafe Podcast, and I'm Marcus. Where do you get inspiration from? I usually get inspired when I'm confronted with something unusual, something I haven't seen before, something my brain seeks to compartmentalize, something that literally extends my view of the world. Like very recently when I visited a film studio with an 8x40, that is 40-meter U-shaped video wall for completely new forms of film production in such great resolution that I immediately had to think about an earlier conversation we had on this show with Georgi Petrov, you know, the space architect who builds for ESA and NASA. Remember when he mentioned how difficult it is in space to build a window to make life in space more enjoyable and less ending up Shining style? So very briefly, we touched on the idea to skip windows altogether and use high-end resolution displays in place. Remember? So as I'm standing in this film studio, completely immersed in this monster of a screen, I could totally imagine the potential of such a thought. Feel stuck on the moon, fire up that alpine 360-degree mountaintop backdrop, and cool down your AC for some immersive feeling. Spare any kind of window to the outside and save a lot of sweat and expenses. Now back to the inspiration bit. Let me challenge you. Let's swap the video wall for an innocent observation, like, why is it that space is still reserved for science and engineering while 99% of the world are not scientists and engineers? Who speaks for the 99% that will ultimately, eventually call this place home? Shouldn't they have a say in all this also? Enter my guest Marie-Pierre Boucher from the University of Toronto. Marie-Pierre is a transdisciplinary thinker and visionary who challenges any status quo she's confronted with. She builds and thinks for and about extreme environments on Earth and in space. And fear not, Marie-Pierre understands extreme in a deeper dimension that I would have ever imagined its meaning to be. Ladies and gentlemen, get ready to immerse yourself in some radical and challenging way of thinking. It's the scientists and engineers who bring us into space, but it's people like Marie-Pierre who challenge us on how the future up there may look like. Before we leap off, I have a very mundane request. In case you're an Apple user, Apple made an update to its podcast subscription app, and you may be experiencing some issues with getting notifications for new episodes on this channel. So please head over to Apple Podcasts and resubscribe to this channel. And whilst doing so, in case you're not on Apple and somewhere else, please recheck all your links for this, as we are migrating to a different distributor, which may affect your subscription status. So as we have got this covered, without further ado, welcome Marie-Pierre Boucher to the Space Cafe Podcast.
It's a call for action, perhaps for like young girls to feel that they can be in the space industry, like, because women have been kind of like discarded or not really celebrated in space history. But also, like, one of the things I think that we're trying to undo is the first narrative. Mm-hmm. We don't claim to see first women, first this. We're trying to undo that and to create something more complex. But yeah.
I think there is so much structural issues in our society underneath or between the lines, which we mostly do not see. Two of my colleagues, female colleagues, told me that during their school time, the girls were taken out of physical exercises, like for half a year, to do self-defense training. And the guys, the boys, were still playing soccer. So the question is, why not take the guys out of soccer training and teach them how to behave properly?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Why the girls?
Yes, that's sad. I have to say that's very sad. But yeah. I think the book, we try to avoid to reproduce the binary between men and women. And we try to complexify that to see that we could ally ourselves rather than distinguishing. Yeah. But certainly, there is a kind of male domination, yes, or patriarchal domination in the space industry. But we don't want to, the book is not about deconstructing that. We think that providing new narratives that are constructive and powerful is better than trying to undo something that we don't like. So we're trying to add more and maybe create more rather than deconstruct. So, yeah.
Let's talk about space and why space is a good launching pad for all of this. Why is the space dominion something that interests you in that respect?
Well, for me, what is interesting about space is that it forces us to reinvent every single kind of relationship that we have with one another, with space, with the environment. It also includes all kinds of technologies like so biotech, nanotech. They all come together for space exploration. So for me, it's a way to encompass most of the technology that we can work on. Also, I think space, there's still a mystery or a desire to discover it or to explore it, which there's still place for new imageries. Or I think one of the things, the problem for me with space is that we always serve the same narratives and the same images. And I think we need to populate visual imagery or conceptual discourses with other types. So I think the book does that. But I think space is it's an open canvas, but at the same time, it's populated. So it's kind of like this dichotomy that becomes interesting for me.
But at the moment, we're doing quite badly from that perspective, because I cannot think of a single female in the space industry of similar importance as Elon Musk and as Jeff Bezos.
No, that's true. So we have the Canadian Space Agency director who's a woman, Lisa Campbell. But it's true that if we think about the industry part, women are often tokenized, actually. They're used for promotion rather than for their intellect or their capacity to contribute. Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. I would love to say, maybe Grimes.
Yeah. Are they still together?
I don't think so.
Not anymore.
Yeah, so I think it would be nice to see. There are some women who are in powerful position. I think about Ariel. She's the director of the Space Initiative at MIT, and she's really leading like really amazing work, but she's not really celebrated or no. That's the thing. Women also, like, I think women prefer to work in the shadows often. So that's also a reason why perhaps we don't necessarily want to be like the leader of anything. That would be behaving like a man in the space industry, right?
How can you transcend those boundaries? How can you go beyond this? Because on the one hand, you're saying it's a female trait to behave just like that, as there are male traits to behave very dominantly. So if you are envisioning a different world out there, how can you go beyond those boundaries?
Well, that's a very good question. And if I had the answer, I think I would already be in space. But I think it's a matter of sustained work. These things, they take a lot of time to change. So I don't think the effects will be felt in the next few months or years. I think that's going to take decades before we can feel the change, right? But I think it's a matter of continuing. Not, you know, you have to like do sustained engagement, like Nahum does, Nelly Benayoun is here does too. Like people are trying to change little by little. For instance, like the woman Pascal, who was the director of the International Astronautical Federation, for a couple of years, when she got into her position, she changed all the titles from the sessions at the Congress. Everything that had colonization, she changed it with exploration. So these are the small changes that will actually be affected. But I think it's kind of difficult to break these boundaries. But we have to come together. I think this is what the project does too. It's like you need a coalition of people for things to change. So yeah.
So we're not colonizing Mars. What are we doing up there?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of just changing the mindset. Mm. If you change the vocabulary, then you change also like the way you think about it. I don't think that I think the companies, they do colonization. Mm. They do exploitation, extraction. Mm. But I think that through changing the vocabulary, and also like I think the goal of people like me is actually to to turn our research in a way that is meaningful to these people. And I wouldn't have said that a few years ago, because for me, it's a bit transfiguring my own research, because I'm not supposed to speak the economic language that they do. But I think this is our duty to actually not transfigure what we work on, but to make it meaningful for people who just want accumulation of capital. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I mean, capitalism is bad, but maybe the accumulation of capital is not so bad. Depends on how it's redistributed, right? So maybe it's the politics of redistribution that we need to work on.
If someone handed the reins of power over to you for a year,
yes,
what would you do differently in the space industry? So you're the boss of SpaceX, you're the boss of Blue Origin, you're the boss of NASA and ESA, and so you have the reins of power for a year.
I think I would create the craziest team of people for advising. I would create a collective way that I would engage, like, the problem for me, I think, with space is that it's only reserved to experts, and lots of the people who don't know about it feel that they are not entitled to be part of the exploration of the project because they are not experts. So I would bring non-experts. I would bring artists, designers. And I have to say, I wouldn't bring artists and designers to make the design look good, but to really think. One of the problems for me is that culture or art or all of these, they are appended. So like you develop a spacecraft, then you add some aesthetic value to it. So myself, what I would want to do is to start the aesthetic value or the cultural value from the onset, rather as something that you can add after. So like when you think about spacecraft, they only think about survival. They don't think about putting colors. They don't think about any of this. They only think about it after, but it's too late in the process. You can't add like as a culture afterwards. So this is what I would do. I would try to like really like have some cultural from the onset. Yeah.
So what would be your main incentive to go into space at all? Because if you do all those things, someone would come along and ask you, so how do I make money with that? So where's the business model behind that?
Well, myself, I have my thinking is that most of us will never go to space, but we will end up living like astronauts on Earth. So like the kind of spacecrafts that we're building are probably the future spacecrafts. Like we might end up like, I take this from Dorian Sagan, who is like the son of Carl Sagan and Lynn Margulis. He wrote this book on biosphere, and he says that he thinks that we will end up living on biospheres on Earth. So it's a little bit this idea that they will make lots of cash, but on Earth by like... we can see that, like, there's this guy named Peter Anker, he's an historian of science. He wrote this paper called The Ecological Colonization of Space, where he explains that it's space exploration that brought the recycling devices on Earth. It's true, the bio toilets, solar panels, and all of that were developed for the space station, right? And then they were adapted for civilian use on Earth. So for me, this is this kind of thing that perhaps the space industry will end up partnering up with industries on Earth to kind of develop space modules or whatever that will be inhabited on Earth. So we can think about like catastrophic places, you know, like when you have hurricanes or these kinds of things, right?
Is this something new that we're ignoring the arts and the humanities in exploration? Has that ever been different in history?
Well, I think NASA always use humans to create their stories of like the heroes of space. Like, you know, this is funny because like historically it's the animals who are the first heroes of space, right? But we never speak about them, right? So there is a hierarchy of who space belongs to a certain extent. I think humans were used a lot. They're still used. Maybe in history there was before more interest, but I think there was a renewed interest in bringing artists and designers in scientific projects, maybe like in the 80s, like it started more or less. But lots of people don't even understand that an artist is not there to make your design look good or beautiful, right? So they instrumentalize the artist. They're not really interested in what the artist can contribute. So yeah, I don't know if I have examples, historical examples, where humans were more at the center or humanist discourses even the development of this self-sustaining spacecraft and so forth was done at the expense of an invention of a form of humanism, right? So you had to have the carrying capacity, to make sure that the spacecraft would be able to carry a certain number of people and so forth. But then this was done at the expense of any kind of psychological things that you could live in. For instance, when we speak about space exploration, do we ever hear astronauts speak about suicide ideas or depression? So these kinds of narratives are important.
It's very interesting. Are you ready for a thought experiment?
Yes.
Let's try to really put ourselves into a world where all this is happening, where you are bringing artists into space, painters, musicians, architects, whatnot. What would a world look like if we had all this? So, for example, I could imagine that someone, a musician, for example, or a painter, who sees space with their own artistic eyes would come back to Earth and produce novel ways of cultural interaction, thereby giving audiences who never go into space a new experience.
Yes.
Is that what you're striving for?
Yeah, I think kind of, there's this documentary by the BBC where they interviewed the three astronauts from the Apollo 8 program who took the the Earth horizon. And the guy, I can't remember his name, the one who took the picture, but he says at the beginning, he says what they should have sent was poets because we were not able to capture the grandeur of what we had seen. So I think this is really important to bring what you, like you just said, like non-specialists or non-experts who can have a different take on it. And there's examples of that actually that happen now. So there's a fabulous French choreographer and dancer named Skitsou Dubois. She started to work in the space industry in the 90s. So she's kind of one of the pioneers. And she brought dancers at the Russian Space Agency, Roscosmos, in parabolic flights. Maybe she did about 20 flights with dancers. And she's trying to reproduce her experience of weightlessness through circus activities, playing with lights and so forth on Earth so that people can have a feeling of what it means. So there's examples of that that are very creative. I think they already exist, but it's a matter of getting more funding. So I think perhaps to respond again to the questions you asked me before, maybe I would do, if I would be leading SpaceX, I would make sure to have some sort of fellowship program where it wouldn't have to be instrumental, but it would be really exploratory, where I would fund these kinds of artists, right?
If I don't know what became of that project, but if I remember correct, Elon Musk announced a couple of years ago that for the first Starship flight around the moon, he would bring only artists on that Starship.
Yes,
can you remember?
Japanese guy. There was a Japanese millionaire who said that he would want to bring 6 artists on space.
Yes.
Yes. Well, the funny thing is that this guy came out in the news a year later saying he was searching for a partner. So I am not sure about the ideas behind that, right? So I don't think artists should go alone too. It's not a matter of creating a class of artists. I think we should go together with different groups of people.
What the Star Trek story had already in the 60s.
Yes, yes.
I think it's a motley bunch of human traits assembled on that spaceship. So you had the engineers and you had the artists and you had the managers and whatnot. So they had it already, and maybe that was a fruitful moment in time. As you already mentioned, people on the show who know me, regular listeners, will get annoyed if I keep coming back to Carl Sagan again. But
yes,
he was the one who was one of the visionaries who dared to express the artistic importance
of space
exploration.
But one of the things he was doing is was really present Carl Sagan in popular media. We don't really have examples of people. There's a few YouTubers today, but we don't have many examples of people who actually care for making this accessible. So Elon Musk goes on all these podcasts, he can smoke weed on podcasts and so forth, but he doesn't. It's more about the celebration of who he is and what he thinks, but it's not really about communicating anything.
I think what we're forgetting is that by bringing artists on board, we're extending and expanding our vocabulary.
Yes.
For something we have no vocabulary for.
Yes.
So it's like going to Mars and analyzing the rocks on Mars without bringing a geologist.
Yeah.
So in fact, you're analyzing the rock formations without any knowledge. So if you don't have knowledge, you don't understand what you're doing. The same could hold true, but please do correct me if I'm wrong, for artists. So if you do not bring an artist, that's only half the experience you're making.
Yes, I think so. But I think you need to bring more than one artist, because one artist cannot carry the weight of this pressure on their shoulders. We cannot like rely and put this pressure on them to solve the problems either. So I think it's really, it has to be a multidisciplinary team, but not just one person of each segment, because some artists disagree with some aesthetics and so forth. So it's a matter of creating politics where difference can be celebrated or recognized or fought for, right?
Are we deliberately throwing away potential by ignoring it?
But also for me, like the biggest throwing away of potential is the instrumentalization of artists. So instead of like having artists like coming with their own instincts or desires or like aesthetics, like we assign them specific projects and we want it to have this kind of impact. It has to be either sustainable or this. So like, this is not
goal-driven.
The way. Yeah, but this is not the way artists work. So like to predetermine a certain goal is also a loss of opportunity.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Why are we discussing this? So what's your background?
So my background, I studied communication science and then visual and media studies. And then I also did postdocs in art history and STS, science, technology, and society. So I have some sort of transdisciplinary background. I used to work creating communication campaigns for public health in developing countries. So that's very far away from what I'm doing now. So I started, my journey came out of this work, working in Africa and in Cuba, doing these information campaigns and realizing that people wanted to change people's behavior with scientific data or scientific means. And I grew frustrated that I felt that you can't assess social or cultural things through scientific lenses. So I moved away from that towards the arts and I started to explore how artists are investing in the development of technology. So I started working on biotech. I did my master's on the artificial uterus, like visiting bio artists in Western Australia, working in biological science laboratories, trying to create new forms of meaning. And then I did my PhD on how astronauts orient themselves in microgravity conditions and how these kinds of perceptual experiences could be used to reinvest or reinvent the way we construct architecture on the kind of architectural projects on Earth. And right now I'm working on a project that is trying to use satellite data for urban communities. So we're trying to develop some protocols so that regular people like you and me could actually use the data for their own sake in the city. So that's a bit of my trajectory.
And one of your special projects and expertise is designing for extreme environments. Is this limited to space or any kind of extreme?
Well, I was interested in the concept of the extreme, but then I started to realize that perhaps it became an empty signifier for several people, that you just see extreme for whatever. You can see extreme for religion. You can see extreme for economics. So like extreme was used as a way to speak about changing markets, right? So like it was used historically in different ways. But my understanding of extreme comes more from Louis Beck, who was an artist based in Paris, who said that the relationship between the extreme depends on the relationship. It's contingent on the relationship. So like, let's say like a trans woman who can't use the bathroom of her choice is facing an extreme environment. So this is the way I work through it. So it's like, perhaps my understanding of an extreme environment is that if it's extreme, it's because it reduces your capacity of action. So how can you like reinvest energies so that you can attach yourself to the environment differently? I think historically, So there's this guy who gave, Ted Kruger, who gave a talk on mediated perception in extreme environments. And he said that one of the sad things actually is that we only develop technology that protects us from these environments. We never really get in contact with them, right? So it's this idea of how do you open the closed environment? So like when, if you think about a spaceship, let's say in space, often they're built in a way that they're completely disconnected from their environment. Nothing from
the... Because the environment is dangerous.
Yeah, but maybe we can find new ways to adapt, you know, like, so perhaps, I'm not exactly sure how this could be done, but this is this kind of opening that I'm trying to get. So like, if you think about space habitats on Mars, everything has to be a closed bubble. So there's no possibility of cultural sharing. So from the onset, if we think that way, then cultural sharing will never happen in space. Everybody will be stuck in their own bubble, a bit like COVID times, right?
It's interesting because what you're referring to in space is also in some way happening on Earth, that we are literally not only communicating socially or living socially inside bubbles, but we are literally detaching ourselves from our environments.
Yes.
The buildings we use, the ACs to control the climate we use,
yes.
It's also a shield,
yes.
To shield us from the extreme environment that is our home at the same time.
Yes, yes.
Because we can't deal with it anymore. We don't even know we're surrounded by plants here. We don't even know the names of those plants anymore. And this has been our home as Homo sapiens,
yes.
For 200,000 years.
Yeah,
so something is seriously going wrong.
Yes, that's it. It's also like, let's say in my project, Space and the City, like I feel that even cities, like there's no more public space in cities. There's no place where you can just loiter or like hang out, right? Loiter. So this idea that space is becoming privatized and everybody has their own little spacecrafts to themselves and so forth. So it's also happening in the city. So like lots of the places we go to, we think it's public space, but it's actually commercial space. Like if you go to a shopping mall and you're in a, this is not public space where you go have your cafe or your coffee. So I see lots of parallels about, so I don't think we necessarily have to go to space to live the bad effects of the way we have like explored it so far. Yeah.
It's all about finding reconnection to where we are.
Yes.
Right now on Earth.
Yes.
In space, it's maybe kind of tricky because it's a deadly place. So I don't know how we would connect with space out there, not the space right here on Earth, but how would we connect with space out there in Mars when it's deadly? But here, down here on Earth, I completely understand. We're using shoes, we're using clothes. It's all a shell to shield us from the environment.
Yes, and also I think, we interviewed for Space Feminism, space engineer Jessie Natba, who's based in South Africa. She runs a company called Astrofika. And she explained us that for her, like when there's a hurricane or a drought or whatever, like the environment is going bad, she said, in South Africa, we don't have the infrastructure to respond to this environmental crisis. But we could learn from space because going to Mars is also starting from new infrastructure. So learning to build the infrastructure necessary on site could be really useful for some of regions in the world that are more prone to climate change, right? So I see that as a positive thing at the same time. But I just think the general public needs to know that they can benefit from space now, not in 50 years, or that they don't need to go to space to benefit from it. So
perhaps it's also once we're breaking down those boundaries, we're making space also a lot more accessible to lay people, to 99% of humans, because it's not only about rocket science. It's also about being or extending our minds as human beings.
Yes.
It's just a new continent.
Yeah. And I like what you say, because I think part of the reason I'm interested in what would it mean to create possibilities to engage with the extreme environments is that myself, I tend to think that people, the way we think about humans in space, nobody is willing to think that humans will be transformed in the process. Right? So like there's this really good movie called Aniara, where it's a spaceship that goes to Mars. They get ejected of the solar of their trajectory, and they don't have no idea when they will come back. And everybody turns crazy, but everybody becomes blind at the end of the movie. So this is one thing, like we're not willing, I think, to change our conception of ourselves. We think that we can go there and remain the same kind of humanity that we have, right? And for me, this is the kind of like this impossibility of thinking transformation that is at the center of the problem, right? Maybe we become something else than humans when we go there. And that's okay too, right?
Do you think, considering what is happening in the world right now, the world that we live in right now is still very industrial. It's very 20th century. It's not 21st century that we're living in right now. So what is that post-industrial world? What is that new incentive that we are working towards? An egalitarian society, for example, and whatnot. So maybe what is happening right now, triggered through artificial intelligence and new kinds of technologies, do you think this is a democratizing momentum that is happening right now?
That's a good question. I don't know. It's a... The democratization, maybe it's like a lure or like a smoke and mirrors. I don't know. Like, it's... I think... It's also, it's the same, perhaps we come back to this same thing in the 90s about free information or access to information. So yes, there's a lot of democratization that people have access, but there's a lack of protocols of application, or people don't, like, for instance.
We're left alone with it.
That's it. So myself, I work on this project where I'm trying to work with the Canadian Space Agency. They have like several sets of data that I could use, but they don't know how I could use it. So there's no protocol. So they collect, but they don't give any protocol to nobody to make that meaningful or powerful or creative. So yes, there's a form of democratization, but it's not because it's open and available that you're able to use it. So I think we are in another step of what it means to democratize technology. It doesn't only, yes, you need to put it in the hands of as many people as possible, but you, without being like a dictator about how you can use it, you should also provide possibilities of utilization.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what is it that you're doing with the Canadian Space Agency?
I have this project called Space and the City, where we're looking at historically, infrastructure, like the electricity grid, the transportation system, telecommunications, and so forth, are shaping processes of urbanization. So like we can see not maybe a direct correlation, but maybe some sort of tensions between the two. So now that most of the infrastructures that we rely upon, well, there's still a lot on Earth, right? Like all the observatories or the cell phone towers or the antennas and like the satellite dishes and so forth. But a lot of that has moved to extra Earth or outside of the Earth's surface. And so this is also affecting processes of urbanization, but at a distance. So what I'm trying to do is to develop some protocols where we could use data from satellites for urban communities to use them. So create some protocols that are not necessarily based on goals of saying like, you need to go faster to your job. So it's just like maybe informal or useless outcomes that I'm trying to. I want people to have the chance to encounter informally. So that my project is about trying to map informal spaces of sharing in the city and to see if space infrastructures have actually decreased this possibility or not, and trying to like give communities the possibility to meet, right?
Can you give me an example of what such a space could be? Like what?
Well, it could be like a park. It would have to be only a place that is not commercially owned, or maybe like... that like the ownership is contested to, like, perhaps, you know, like if you think about like the kind of welfare programs around around urbanization or social housing, where the kind of partnerships between the city, the population, and so forth. So they have some example of that. There's a lot also like of examples in South America, because South America endured mass urbanization much before Africa or Asia. And so they have a lot of projects, for instance, architects who would give people a prototype of a house that they could expand according to their own needs. So this is kind of a bringing the lay public as part of their decision making, and that having like the star architect like landing into a place and like imposing their values to everybody. So there is
this is what it has to be, and yeah, there's no you don't have any say in all this.
Yeah. So what would it mean for people to be able to feel? It's also like creating feelings of belonging to the place where you are. Not just like that you're it's not utilization, or that you belong to that place and you care for it and you want to be part of it. It's also like creating these kinds of values, right? Because today with the kind of public-private dichotomy, it's very difficult for people to feel that they belong to a place or that they should take care of it, right? It should be the city, it should be the government, it should be this. So like, it's kind of like, how can you bring back some this sense of belonging and care, basically?
From your work so far, do you know or have you heard of projects that are already very progressive, working toward that direction? Are there any space agencies and whatnot more interested than others?
Well, I think there's a lot of people who are trying to be progressive and stuff, but it's just like everybody works in their own little... We need a way to get together and to connect together. I think it's not necessarily the space agencies that are more or less. I think it depends on the people who work in the space. So like myself, I know some people who are astrophysicists at the European Space Agency, for instance, who have been working so hard to help people like me getting involved, you know, like getting more artists, trying to like communicate as much as possible and really helping the people like me, normal people who are not experts in space, access these locations. So it's more people-based than organization-based, I think.
So maybe we're lacking, or we could use a lot more momentum towards imagination of new spaces. And this can only be supported by additional voices to round all this up, I guess. So, and you're calling for those additional voices to have a seat at the table.
Yes.
I think it's as simple as that.
Well, because for me, for instance, I'm a communication or information scholar, we call this media scholar, whatever. So my role for most people is to actually communicate science to people. I'm used to make people understand something. So I'm never going to be invited at the decision-making room, because I'm there at the end of the process just to communicate. And this is the wrong part of it. It's the same as culture. You can't add a discipline after the project is carried, right? So yes, I think we need more people at the decision taking. And also like not only people like me who are profs and stuff, people, lay publics, we need them too. They should be involved. Like they're the one who pay the taxes for NASA, right? So yeah.
I like that. Where do we stand? Is the Canadian Space Agency, are they more open than ESA, NASA?
Well, the Canadian Space Agency has a much lower budget than NASA. So I think the budget of the Canadian Space Agency is close to the marketing budget of NASA. So we can't compare these things. I think the European Space Agency, what is interesting about it is that it's distributed across different countries in Europe and that there's different politics of access and it creates a different kind of dynamic. So that's quite interesting. I think the European Space Agency has been supporting a lot of initiative. I know lots of artists who have been. Then NASA, I think they're also open, but it's just like, I don't think... Like my father could call NASA and go, you see, like, so it's like you need to have some sort of credentials to access. So maybe we should break these boundaries of access, right?
There's an interesting, it's not rocket science, it's not the space industry, but I'm also affiliated with the particle physics people at CERN in Geneva. And they have a recurring, interesting project to invite science fiction authors into their premises or onto their premises to help them come up with new ideas. The crazier, the better.
Yeah, because it's such a weird place, right?
Exactly.
It's quite difficult to get creative there.
Exactly. So who has not seen CERN...
Doesn't know about that.
It could use a rebuild.
Yes.
But what I'm told is that every cent that comes into CERN is being invested into science and into the latest bits and pieces of technology, but not into infrastructure. Like what the offices look like. It looks like dates back to the 60s, yeah. I guess.
Yeah.
The offices. I love their offices because they're the regular office of a scientist or a project engineer is a cubicle sized room with a black or green board. It's even a green board because they're even older. Wooden desk dating back to the 60s, a chair, a laptop, and that's about it. And an additional chair for visitors.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah, it's a weird place. But I think this is a great thing. And I have to say, I think some scientists already do that. So when I visited the Johnson Space Center for my research, for my PhD research, I met this guy named Robert Howard, who's a human factors engineer who worked on the development of the Orion module. And he's also a science fiction writer. He publishes science fiction. And it's really funny because when I visited NASA, I knew that because I had made my research on him. None of his colleagues knew about it. So that's very interesting to see that even a scientist still wants to engage with more than what is there, right? Mm-hmm. So like if you're like that's crazy that he has time to do that, I have to say. But this is, I think this is kind of interesting that maybe you don't necessarily need the science fiction. You need the science fiction writer, but it's interesting also to see like what would the scientist write as science fiction and to like do these interplays between different roles and force people maybe to adopt another position. It's also that, right? Mm. How can you be transformed in the process of what you're doing?
Mm. Wonderful. Are you a science fiction buff?
Well, I have to say... I was not into really deep into science fiction, but my partner is a filmmaker. His name is Dominique Gagnon, and he did a movie where he asked me to bring some of my ideas or share my expertise with him in the process when he was making the film.
And it's what is the movie called?
It's called Space Down. It's titled Space Down. It's a 1 hour. It's a movie made with found footage videos from the internet. So it's a basically he paired. Visuals from space exploration, from extreme environments, extreme workplace, caves and stuff like that. And he paired that with audio testimonies of people during COVID. So he brought a very different narrative that is not about progress or that is more a psychological thriller about suicide, self-mutilation, depression, sexuality. So like all the people, the mechanisms they created to cope with COVID is similar to the way people were talking to us about astronauts. So he kind of like developed this idea that that perhaps in cyberspace, you find some sort of Lee community or Lee space program or like a civilian space program on YouTube, right? So, and because of that, he was working on that during COVID. So we watched every single science fiction movie that existed online. So now I think I like it.
Do you have a favorite one?
Aniara. So it's one of the things that I'm a bit puzzled with space exploration is that often in the movies, it's only one person.
Saving the world?
Yeah. Or who is being saved by the world? So like, let's say Matt Damon, he grows potatoes. So the good thing about that is that now we know we can have vodka on Mars, right?
Yeah.
But so you have Sandra Bullock who finishes alone in Gravity. You have Brad Pitt in Ad Astra who has the psychological, who does psychoanalysis with his dad. Mm. So this is completely crazy. So Aniara is a very different, so it's made from I can't remember the name, Martin Harrison, I think his name is a poet from Sweden. And so this was a poem that was adapted to like comedy, music, whatever. But there was a film that was made about it. And it's this thing that I was telling you before when they get ejected of their trajectory. But what I like about this movie is that it's taught at the population scale. There's a lot of people in the ship and it's kind of a collective. And it, so, yeah. So this is my favorite. But I have to say, this is a very, I wouldn't say depressing, but it's a bit challenging. So like, if you're depressed, don't watch it alone. If you're depressed, I would wait until you feel better to watch it. Also, don't watch it alone because it's a little bit intense.
You're making me curious now. So where is it playing?
It was released in 2019. So you can find it online.
I can find it online. Good.
Yes.
And the movie of your partner?
It's we're waiting for it to get released. Like, so the details about this will come soon. But yeah, it's.
But is there a trailer somewhere?
Yes, on Vimeo. On Vimeo, like his name is Dominique Gagnon with a C, Dominique Gagnon. And he has a Vimeo. You can find all of his movies on Vimeo. But there is the trailer on Vimeo.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Would he be okay with you going into space to Mars? If the call came right now and you told him, hey, I could go to Mars tomorrow, would you be okay with that?
I think he would probably be okay, but myself, I wouldn't go.
You wouldn't go?
No.
Why not?
Well, I don't think I'm psychologically
stable.
I think.
No, I'm sorry, but
I don't mean that. But I think like I tend to panic in close environments and stuff. I'm a little bit claustrophobic, so I don't think I would have.
Well, we're talking space.
With lots of medication, I could probably do it.
But we're talking about Starship-type spaceships, so you got all the space you want.
Okay, maybe, yes, I would, but it's like, I saw this like post on online when they were saying, like, so maybe one day we terraform Mars, allowing humans to be miserable on multiple planets. So I'm just like, yeah, but what would I do if I go there? I mean, like, that's one thing to go, but like...
After 3 weeks, it's getting boring, I guess.
Yeah, that's it. Maybe after 3 days, you know? I'm not sure what I would do if I would move to Mars.
But do you play an instrument? Maybe make music or do some painting or... So it's getting boring quite...
Yeah, I'm not sure what I would do, honestly. It's not... That
Watch
appealing
Netflix.
To me, I'm more if I can get it there, you know, like 5 minutes delay for everything. But yeah, I think for me, I think that I'm already in space. The Earth is in the solar system.
Yes.
So that's why I start to, like, I'm taking this from an artist based in Berlin, Agnes Meyer-Brandis. She speaks about extra Earth. She doesn't say outer space.
And because space is part of Earth.
Yes, because we are in space.
We're on a spaceship.
Yes, the
spaceship. We just don't notice.
Yes.
We've gotten used to it.
Yes.
Mm. So, speaking of boredom and loneliness, assume you go into space, you're traveling to Mars. It's a long journey. Which piece of music would you want to bring? Which single tune would you not want to miss on that journey? And the reason I'm asking is I have a Spotify playlist for the aspiring space traveler. And each of my guests contribute one tune to that playlist. So what is yours?
Oh, that's funny. Well, one of my favorite songs is Surrender from Suicide. So that would be,
that
because
like
it's very
uplifting.
Calm. Well, it's calm. I think I wouldn't bring like a death metal. I don't think so. Maybe I would need it, but I don't think this is what I would go with. But actually, maybe what I would go with, you know, this story about Scrambles of Earth. Mm-hmm. So like with the Voyager disc, they send music, right? And there's people, I think it's at SETI or I can't remember who they are, where they are based, but they kind of made the artwork with that and they remixed the whole music. And they said that it was intercepted by aliens who remixed the music and sent it back to Earth. And they even say that officially, you're not supposed to listen to it on Earth because the copyright belongs to the aliens.
Ah, interesting.
So you can find it on Spotify, actually. It's called Scrambles of Earth, and it's really good because you have the sounds from space that are added to the kind of like classical music and stuff. So it's
so now we know what kind of music the aliens like.
Yeah. Well, a projection of humans thinking what they...
Yeah, of course.
You know, Natalie Cabral at SETI, she always says that we have always been searching for other versions of ourselves. So it's time to change the kind of like signals that we're looking for so that we don't miss the aliens perhaps because we're just looking for ourselves, right?
Speaking of which, do you think we're alone?
I hope not. But I myself, I tend to think that often we portray aliens or as like lower class. Maybe we live in a simulation and they're all laughing at us, right?
Like right now?
Yes. No, but
now, right, like right now, they're saying they're listening in on us.
Maybe, yeah.
And they're saying,
"Oh my God, they're so
no,
stupid."
No, she does not get it. She doesn't exactly. get it. It's not that difficult.
But it's the thing that I think that we always think that if we meet another life form, it's necessarily going to be lower than us. And I tend to think that maybe if there exists some, they might be more intelligent than us.
I don't even understand what lower and higher means because we have no access. I don't have cognitive access to an ant or a mouse. So I don't know what's going on in their minds.
No, that's it.
So maybe they're super smart. I don't know. We assume they're
not.
And religion has told us for centuries that we are the cream of
everything. Maybe they are, right? You don't know. So... It's also
or the
like
slime mold.
Like, how can we undo our assumptions?
Yes.
So for me, that's a bit the idea of space. Is why I'm so interested in space, because it forces you to rethink all the basic relationships, and then you can take up to the challenge or not. It's your choice.
I think the great thing is, it's a great opportunity, but the most difficult thing to do is to allow a restart and to be open to start anew. I think because this requires lots of boldness.
Yes.
And maturity.
But perhaps we shouldn't call it starting anew. I think this is also part of the capitalist system. Like the exit strategy, the new beginnings, the start. It's also like really like the ideals of the modernist project from Europeans getting into South America, right? The tabula rasa in architecture was very important. So perhaps we should speak about metamorphosis or transformation rather than restart or new beginning.
Yes.
Because also like, what if we're like attentive to what's happening with, indigenous communities, right? So like if we do a restart, we negate all the violence that happened in the past. And I think it's a matter of not negating that violence. We shouldn't celebrate it, but we have to recognize it. And that's part also of the transformation process.
One last question.
Yes.
This show is called the Space Cafe Podcast.
It's nice.
It's a coffee
place.
My
coffee.
You got
your
coffee. And now and then you have coffee to energize yourself. So why don't you share an espresso for the mind with me, with the audiences right now? So try to come up with a shot of inspiration that you feel like that could be inspiring to audiences. And you can pick whatever kind of topic you want to pick. We have been very inspiring already on that show. So, but maybe you have one more shot of inspiration for us.
One more shot of inspiration about space?
Whatever kind of topic you want.
I think you should watch Space Down, and that's going to be a very good shot. I invite all your people to watch Space Down. I think that's going to be a good shot of inspiration because it's bringing back space really down on Earth. Well, it's using Earth as space, right? And I think there's a lot of provocative statements in the movie. Also amazing music and editing. So that would be my takeaway message. And you'll have to watch it to understand what I mean.
Wonderful. Marie-Pierre, thank you
thank
so much.
Thank you, Marcus.
Hey, it was fun.
Yes.
Two movies on the watch list. Before I let you off the tether, my friends, if you like this episode, why don't you share it with someone you like and feel it could be an inspiration for? Just grab a link and WhatsApp or signal it over. Yes, I want to grow our little universe. It's episode 105 already, and my mind keeps expanding with every guest, just like the Hubble tension that discusses how the universe not only increasingly expands faster and faster the further out you go, but also depending on where you look. So perhaps the universe is not the giant infinite sphere that is expanding out into whatever that out there is, but rather an unevenly pointy shape with infinite spikes of different sizes around its perimeter. My mind is blown, and I promise I will have someone on the show very soon to explain all this in more professional detail. Until then, thank you for being part of this journey. It means a lot to me. Bye-bye.